I happen to do well in dreary, drizzly weather. I feel like I must have been a lizard in a previous life. I live in a terrarium, and I'm thankful for it.
That is Rick Steves. As in, well, Rick Steves. Because if you have ever bought a travel book or planned a trip to Europe, you probably know Rick Steves. For 40 years, he has been the leading authority on European travel in the U.S. He has written dozens and dozens of books. He hosts a TV show on PBS. He has a radio show and a podcast. Rick is a legend in the travel writing space. Rick has been all over the world, but when we asked him to tell us about the three places that have helped shape his life, he started close to home, with his hometown of Edmonds, Washington.
It's just an idyllic, wonderful little corner of the world here where the mountains hit the sea, a half hour north of Seattle. I can look out my window right now and see my junior high school. So I haven't gone very far. You know, it's surrounded by trees. I love the salt water. And I live in a community that loves to travel. And Kathmandu is a household word.
You must be a little bit of a celebrity in your hometown. Like, people must flag you down and be like, hey, Rick, I got him planning a trip. I need to ask you a question. Yeah.
Well, luckily, people are inclined to thank me for their travels. Hmm. People will go, Rick, thank you for Malta. And, you know, if I've never done anything Malta, what am I going to say? I just go, well, you're welcome, you know. But people just, they think that if they had good travels, for some reason, they blame me, which is a nice problem to have.
I'm Dylan Thuris, and this is Atlas Obscura, a celebration of the world's strange, incredible, and wondrous places. Our guest today is Rick Steves, and he has seen a lot of strange, incredible, and wondrous places over his career. And today, he is going to guide us through three places that helped shape his life. After visiting his hometown of Edmonds, Washington, Rick took us to a time when he was just a teenager and visiting Europe for the very, very first time. This brings us to the second place that shaped Rick's life.
One day, my dad came home from work and said, son, we're going to Europe to see the piano factories. And I thought, Dad, that is a crazy idea. I didn't want to do that. That's stupid. I don't speak the language. Why would I go over there?
Why the piano factories? Why was that the thing?
Well, my dad was a piano tuner. He was a really respected piano tuner in Seattle. And he decided to import pianos from Germany. Some old German told him, hey, you should import these amazing pianos. Because the best pianos in the world were made in Germany and in Vienna, also in Austria. So we went over there. My dad thought, okay, we'll try that. And we went over there and went to the piano factories in Germany. And then we went up to the relatives up in Norway. Was that 69? I was 14 years old. And it was the Apollo moon landing time, right? Mm-hmm. And everybody was watching. And I was with relatives in Norway when Neil Armstrong stepped on the moon. And I'll never forget, as a 14-year-old kid on the carpet in front of the TV in Norway with all the adults, you know, sitting in the chairs, but I was there with my cousins on the carpet like a bunch of little rugrats. And I knew that Americans were waving their flag, just going, yay, America's on the moon. But I also knew that in Norway, like random places all over the world, people were tuning in. It wasn't a giant one step for mankind and a giant leap for mankind. It was en lite skritt for mänskheten and a giant leap for mankind. You know, I listened to it in Norwegian. And it just, as a little 14-year-old twerp, it had an impact on me that this is a vast and beautiful and diverse humanity. On that same trip, Dylan, I was behind the Royal Palace in this vast park called Frogner Park, littered with nude concrete statues by a guy named Gustav Wigeland. And it was, first of all, I was sort of both embarrassed and infatuated by all of this concrete nudity. and I don't know, granite, I don't know, marble, concrete, granite. Yeah. There's all this carved stone nude statues.
They're quite intense statues too. They're like, they're semi-graphic even, kind of, or at least weird.
They really are. Yeah. You could just wander around that park for hours and be thinking all sorts of interesting things. It's got a circle of statues of people going through different stages of life. You know, there's birth, there's childhood, there's puberty, there's your first love, there's marriage, there's having kids, there's getting older, there's getting really frail, and then you die. Scandinavia is kind of a dark approach to this kind of death and mortality and all that kind of thing. And then the centerpiece is this rocket of humanity. It's like a massive obelisk, you know, you know those Egyptian obelisks, and it's made of a tangle of bodies. And when I look at it, I pan up from the pedestal right up, and it almost comes with the soundtrack of a rocket taken off at Cape Canaveral. And it's just this tangle of bodies, and it's rocketing toward the heavens. It's called the Monolith of Life. But I remember being in that park. It was a beautiful park. And I remember my parents were just loving me. And I was very egocentric and like a kid, you know, but I was clued in enough to see that they're compromising hugely to take me to Europe with them. They didn't have a lot of money. It was their first trip ever. And they were taking care of me. And I was not the greatest travel partner. And then I looked out over that park, and it was speckled with other families. And I just, it seemed like a Monet painting. It just stretched forever with other families, with parents loving their kids. And it occurred to me, those parents love their kids as much as my parents love me. Whoa, what a radical concept. This world is home to billions of equally lovable little children of God, you know? And I just, it was a mind-blowing eureka. That seems sort of maybe childish and maybe simple, maybe obvious, but I think it was a very big breakthrough in my outlook. And I make a pilgrimage to the Frogner Park every time I'm in Oslo now.
Okay, so you're 14, you take this trip. It's not only your first trip to Europe, it's your parents' first trip to Europe. It's the year of the moon landing, which you watch in Norway. You go to this sculpture park filled with giant naked bodies. What effect did this have on 14-year-old Rick Steves?
It emboldened me, Dylan, to want to see the world as my playground. The day after I graduated from high school, I was on the flight to Europe, and that was the first trip without parents, just with a buddy of mine. And, you know, that was that $3 a day backpacker, Eurail pass trip. And that was the epic European trip. And it was so beautiful, in part because I was so green, I was so scared, I was so poor, yeah. I was so out of my comfort zone. And, you know, we just did it. Back then, I was a piano teacher. Kids wouldn't practice in the summer, so I thought, I'm not going to struggle with that. I'll see you in September. I'm going to Europe on a super tight budget.
I did exactly this. I was 17 years old. My buddy was 18. We took off. We spent 6 weeks. We did all, you know, we went to the big, we went to the Eiffel Tower. We, like, got a big stein of beer in Germany. That might have actually been my first beer.
Isn't that great?
Yeah, and it just, you felt like, wow, if I can manage to do this, sort of anything is possible.
Yep.
Totally.
Yep. You look at 17 and 18-year-olds now through a parental point of view, and you kind of go, boy, is that really okay? But it is. It is okay. I mean, people say have a safe trip now. They don't say bon voyage, but statistically, it's safer now than it was then to travel. Yeah. I mean, you know, there's many more safeguards. You can be in touch with your loved ones at home for free with your phone. Back then, you can remember, it was tough to connect back home in those days. I'm older than you, I think. So it was like going behind the dark side of the moon.
Yeah.
You know, you'd send a postcard because you couldn't afford to. I mean, 2 minutes on the phone would be like a day of my budget. I just can't do that, Mom and Dad.
Okay, so you have this experience. You get a few years older. You go back to Europe after high school. What is the place where you had the kind of moment and said, okay, this is really going to be my career?
I remember in South England, I love moors, these time past sort of abandoned commons lands that have this patina of age, everything about them. The wind comes with stories, you know. And I stayed in a very rustic youth hostel, and I hiked across that mossy, windblown, desolate landscape to my own private Stonehenge, this stone circle. And I had just been to Stonehenge itself with porta potties and barbed wire and tour guides with blowhorns and a tour bus parking lot and noisy groups. And it just, there was nothing soulful or magic about Stonehenge. It was just a touristy thing. And then I found myself all alone in this windy, desolate landscape in a moor with this, I think it's called the Scorehill stone circle.
For people who've never been to Stonehenge or aren't really familiar with what a stone circle is, what is it? What does it look like?
Oh, yeah. Well, a stone circle is usually, roughly as old as the pyramids in Egypt. They're 5,000 years old. And in that day, there were societies, mysterious societies, we don't know much about them, but they moved massive stones to special places, sometimes where ley lines would cross. I mean, if you're into that kind of New Age stuff, there's something to it. And how did they get those stones? Nobody knows. They might have levitated them and they might have, you know, sledded them across the ley line. I don't know. And I'm not going to judge it. I wouldn't surprise me if there's something going on that we don't understand, just like they didn't understand electricity back then, you know. And what they would do is they would assemble these stones into a circle, and the circle became a holy place. And it told the seasons, it told the days by where the sun rose and where the sun set. Hmm. So these druids would gather there in the summer solstice. I mean, depending on where the sun set and rised with these stone circles, it would tell those people in those societies when to party, when to work, when to have a religious festival and so on. And they still serve as celestial calendars to this day. And to this day, druids boogie on the summer solstice at every stone circle around England. I mean, they come alive. And I remember being impressed by how great that was, how it was not in any information, and how many people could benefit from somebody being their lead man and finding these things and writing it up. And the next day, as I was taking the boat to France from England, it occurred to me, this is my calling. I need to find places like this, desolate Stonehenge, you know, and then write them up. And the first edition of my book, Europe Through the Back Door, came out in 1980, and it was two books in one, How to Travel, and then examples of places that nobody goes to that are really rewarding and magical.
Okay, we've got Edmunds, we've got the Vigeland Sculpture Park, and we have Score Hill Stone Circle. All of these in their own way have this kind of interesting magic to them. I find that my kind of search for awe and wonder and things that just kind of fill me with a sense of possibility to be sort of connected to my own personal sense of spirituality. And you're a practicing Lutheran. I'm curious if that's something that enters into how your kind of spiritual beliefs like enter into your sense of exploring the world.
I think it's interesting when we think about how we travel. You can travel as a tourist, you can travel as a traveler, and you can travel as a pilgrim. Mm. Nothing's right or wrong. It's just you have the opportunity to mix it up the way you want. It's how do you want to do that? Do you want to be just a fun-loving tourist and go to all the commercial gimmicks and hang out on the beach and enjoy your duty-free shopping? That's fine. But if you do a whole trip halfway around the world and back, and that's as deep as you get, you've lost some opportunities. Do you want to be a traveler? A traveler is somebody who's out there to learn, to try different things, to broaden their perspectives, you know, to get out of their comfort zone. That's a good thing. And you want to be a pilgrim. And a pilgrim is somebody who travels like people do when they're on a pilgrimage, to learn more about themselves, to get closer to God, to find the meaning of life.
Yeah.
I don't know many people that would want to just do solely that. But those who are able to mix it all together, I think, have a richer experience. And I just love to be on top of the Alps and just feel like I'm walking on a ridge. Imagine you're hiking on a ridge high in the Swiss Alps above the valleys. And on one side, you got lakes stretching all the way to Germany. And on the other side, you got the most incredible alpine panorama anywhere, the Eiger, Monk, and Jungfrau, just cut glass peaks. And ahead of you, you hear the long legato tones of an Alp horn announcing that the helicopter-stocked mountain hut is open. It's just around the corner and the coffee schnapps is on. And you're tightroping on this ridge. It's just, it's enough to make even a Lutheran raise their hands to the heavens and go, life is good. Thank you, God. You know, I mean, that's a beautiful thing to be able to experience.
Yeah.
And I just love that.
So Rick has taken us through his little seaside hometown of Edmunds, Washington, off to Vigeland, this Norwegian sculpture park full of giant nude stone people, and to this mysterious British stone circle. But since this is Rick Steves, we wanted to keep him on a little longer. Up next, Rick looks back on his very first book, Europe Through the Back Door, which was published in 1980. And I will ask him how his philosophy of traveling has shaped his view on other things. I just have to ask, have you ever considered writing a travel guide? Best places to smoke a joint with Rick Steves? It would make a great show.
It sure would, wouldn't it? Yeah.
That's coming up. long before it was kind of socially acceptable, you were a strong and vocal advocate for legalizing marijuana. It seems like a kind of a risky position to take as a public figure. Why did it feel important? Was this an influence of Europe on you? Where does this kind of figure into your story?
In Europe, they're not about legislating morality, which comes so natural to Americans. Legislating morality, that'll solve the problem. Yeah, right. I think anybody who has enjoyed recreational marijuana in their youth and still enjoys it today understands the frustrations and the lies and the heartache of a federal prohibition against marijuana.
Yeah.
I just think it's a wrong-minded, sad situation in our country, and especially these days when privileged white people can smoke with impunity, but people of color and poor people are getting arrested and locked up. It's happening to this day, even though half of our country now has recreational marijuana that is legal to enjoy, the civil liberty. And when I started being an advocate for legalizing marijuana, it was scary,
yeah.
You know. And I was, people couldn't believe what I was talking about. But it was very principled. It was civil liberties. It was anti-racism. It was a principled thing. It wasn't pro-marijuana. It was pro-civil liberties to enjoy marijuana if you want to.
Yeah.
And by the way, I do, you see.
Yeah.
And so I just became I could more effectively promote a common sense European approach to marijuana in the law by using my what I learned in Europe. Europe is all about pragmatic harm reduction. You know, in much of Europe, a joint is about as exciting as a can of beer. I was a co-sponsor and leading spokesperson of the law in Washington State in 2012 that legalized marijuana, not medical marijuana, not decriminalized marijuana, legalized marijuana, the enjoyable, just the right for mature adults to enjoy smoking pot. And now I think 25 states have legalized. And so it's a big job to dismantle the federal prohibition against marijuana. But I think it's very equivalent to the prohibition against alcohol. When they finally legalized alcohol after prohibition, they weren't saying booze was good. They were saying the laws designed to protect us from the alcohol were causing more heartache in our society than the alcohol itself. And that's the case with marijuana today. The laws designed to protect us from marijuana are actually causing more problem than the abuse of marijuana itself, by my estimate. So yeah. it's a cool crusade to be in because I think it's so common sense. And one of my favorite things is to have a conservative crowd and give me 15 minutes to explain why we should stop arresting pot smokers. And, yeah. And I can have a big impact on their outlook.
Yeah. I just have to ask, have you ever considered combining these things, like writing a travel guide, best places to smoke a joint with Rick Steves? It would make a great show. You know,
if it
you
sure
wanna,
would.
If you want to co-host something together, I'm available.
You're there?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I'm interested.
Yeah. I would say that I wrote a book called Travel as a Political Act, and it talks about how my travels have impacted my politics. And there's quite an extensive chapter in there on drug policy reform and how the issue is in Europe and how it relates to what we're doing in the United States. And I love being able to share how if I travel with an open mind and I hang out with people who find different truths to be self-evident and God-given, and I realize that different societies are struggling with the same things and we have different ways to deal with them, and let's compare notes. I've learned a lot through my travels.
Europe Through the Back Door is in its 40th edition, 40th printing, 40th year. When you look back on that first edition, is it sort of like this time capsule to see how you traveled 25 years ago? What is it like to look back on your advice over these years and feel the changes?
I've been in a kind of nostalgic mode for the last few years here, and I've been looking at old journals, and I've got a page, the last page of that journal that I wrote. It was 80 nights, and I did all this like line-by-line accounting of the expenses. Average cost per night, 82 cents for my accommodations.
Yeah.
82 cents. You can't get a room for less than $100 now, you know. So it was a different time. Europe is well discovered now. You got to admit that.
Yeah.
So now the challenge is not to find undiscovered places, but it's to go to discovered places and enjoy them in a way that gets around the crowds and the gimmicks and stuff. And there's ways to do that. the new focus to me is experiences in Europe, not a checklist of famous sites. You got to see those too, but how do you roll up your sleeves and get your fingers dirty in the local culture? And there's good ways to do that. You know, if you go to Helsinki, every hotel has a sauna, every cruise ship has a sauna, but you're going to be hanging out naked with other tourists. I'd rather hang out naked with Finns.
Yeah.
Oh, and Finns, they don't need public saunas anymore because they're wealthy enough to have a sauna in their own homes. So that locks out the tourist. But if you go to a working class neighborhood in Helsinki, there, people who live in apartments, they want to have that good Finnish sauna, but they don't have one in their own home. So they go to the neighborhood sauna. That's where you can go. Now, there's not a word of English there, but you're going to get in there. You're going to feel like Mr. Magoo, who's lost his glasses, and you're going to be able to have a Finnish sauna with Finnish people. And you're not a tourist. You're just another hunk of flesh sitting on that bench sweating. And those experiences are there. You know, they're there in every country. You just got to find them.
It's a very rude question, but you said I could ask a rude question.
Okay.
When you did Backdoor to Europe, did you know that it was like a double entendre for like a sex act? Because I've just wondered if this has come to bother you or people bring it up. I just had to ask.
I love it. I love that it causes people to snicker or whatever. I had no idea. My dad came up with that. Europe through the back door, son. It's that casual, catch it by surprise, you know? And then of course, it was the gay connotation or whatever. I had a lesbian publicist in the Bay Area once, and I went down, and she's French. And this is when I was just in my 20s, just starting out, self-published. And I went down to San Francisco, and I was just crashing at her place, and she was having a big party. And all of her French gay friends were there. And I'm just this straight Norwegian guy. And I'm just sitting on the front porch, just shaking my head, thinking, this is a wild world. And then she invites me in, and she goes, in French, she goes, blah, 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 Rick Steves, Europe through the back door, blah, 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 blah. And everybody just burst into hysterics. And I thought, oh, this has a special angle on this market.
All right, very last question, final question. You know, you talked about the Vigeland Sculpture Park as this really moment of eye-opening realization that the world is big and filled with interesting stuff, you know. And you know, when you first went to that sculpture park, you were 14. And so there were, you know, there's sculptures of kids and people of every age. So there was sort of kids' sculptures reflected back to you. And now when you go there, you're farther along that trajectory, right? You're starting to, in the circle of life around the fountain, you're moving farther along. And, you know, I'm curious how it feels to revisit places, you know, 20 years later, 30 years later, how it feels to feel your own life kind of progress through this work and through these locations.
Well, I got to say, I love Europe from top to bottom. And right now, I'm 68, and I'm going to keep doing this as long as I'm physically able, but, you know, it's not going to be forever. And I'm getting to the point where I'm thinking, is this the last time I'm going to be in Hamburg? Is this the last time I'm going to update the chapter to Leipzig? You know, is this the last time I'm going to get a chance to go to Porto with my work and with my guidebook and with my friends who are the local guides? I'm going to all those places in the next few months, and I've got guides booked. And it's a weird extra dimension of my mindset as I come into these towns. Will I get to Aarhus again? You know, I love Belfast. You know, I want to do more on the west coast of Ireland. I want to make sure my little town in the south coast of Portugal is still good. You know, I want to take that fast boat from Athens to Idra, and I want to be there, and I want to be drinking that nice cloudy glass of ouzo in that favorite taverna as the sun's going down and looking out over the sunset on the Aegean Sea. I don't know how many times, I'm not going to get back to all those places again, you know, and I'm totally enjoying going back to them again now, and I still have to do my work. And then do I want to cut off on the work, and do I want to just go there and have fun? That's a concept that weighs kind of heavy on me. So right now I'm working a little more on training my staff so that I can be more picky and choosy with the work that I choose to do going forward. So it's a nice problem to have. I love my work. I think it keeps me young. It's just absolutely fun, and it's also kind of exhausting. And you know, and then when I get home, I'm still in little old Edmonds here, and I can still look out the window and like I am right now and see my old junior high school. So maybe the reason I'm so comfortable traveling, I've spent a third of my adult life living out of a 9 by 22 by 14 inch carrying the airplane sized suitcase overseas. is because I'm well-rooted right here. I'm really thankful that I live here.
Rick Steves is a travel writer, author, television personality, and America's most respected authority on European travel, and my favorite travel writer out there. Thanks so much for joining us, Rick.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Always good to be with you. Thanks, and best wishes with your work.
Our podcast is a co-production of Atlas Obscura and Stitcher Studios. This episode was produced by
Amanda McGowan,
Julia Russo.
The production team includes
Doug Baldinger,
Chris Naka,
Camille Stanley,
Manolo Morales,
Baudelaire,
Gabby Gladney,
Johanna Mayer.
Our technical director is
Casey Holford.
This episode was mixed by
Luce Fleming.
If you want to learn more, be sure to visit atlasobscura.com. There's a link in our episode description. And our theme and end credit music is by Sam Tyndall. I'm Dylan Thuris, wishing you all the wonder in the world. I will see you next time.